Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
Try and come up with one. Mm-hmm. 109, and this is John. I do have something I'm going to read you that's for big thoughts. Stand by.
Oh, have mercy.
You'll be glad you stood by. We're here until 3 o'clock. We'll also talk a little bit about the Cubs baseball team with the author of a book about the Cubs, Rich Cohen. And I know what you're thinking. Hey, John, I don't want to hear another book about the Cubs. What is it, about the curse? Actually, the title of the book is The Chicago Cubs Story of a Curse. It's written by Rich Cohen, and I think he rescues the book from the title because it's about the curse, but it's not really. I mean, we all know that there's this billy goat or a black cat, and the Cubs never won. And that story's been told, and it's not even real, so who cares? What I care about are the great stories of the franchise, and he squeezes some wonderful anecdotes out about three-finger Mordecai Brown and about Tinkers, Evers, and Chance. And maybe you know about all of these guys because you're a great baseball student, but I'm not, and I just found this thing fascinating. He's going to join us in studio in the 2 o'clock hour. We'll talk a little bit more about that. By the way, speaking of the Cubs, I was lucky enough to get a ticket to the game last night. I got two. Got two tickets to last night's game. It's funny that some people weren't using their tickets to last night's game, what with it being on television and all. But as I was walking out the door, somebody said, hey, here's a couple tickets, and I took them. So I got home. I live near Wrigley Field. I didn't get home until about the second inning, which worked out fine for us because I can park right there at our place. And then we just literally walked a couple of blocks to Wrigley Field. We got there in the third. And the outcome wasn't known yet. The outcome being that we were going to lose, that we were going to give up a late inning grand slam, and that it was just going to be miserable, and that we weren't going to score any runs.
I saw your pictures, and I actually thought that you could, because I'm like, wow, it must be freezing, but you could go home and warm up for a few innings and come back.
We really could. I mean, like, we left at the top of the ninth. We were home watching it on TV before the end of the top of the ninth. That's just how close I live to Wrigley Field, but that's another story. So we go to the game, and it's swell because there was a sense of sort of camaraderie. It's like when you go to a Bears game, maybe, and it's bad weather. There's must be a sort of esprit de corps. Hey, we're all going to get through this weather because we're tough and we're having fun. And there was a little bit of that. Of course, it was blowing this awful mist, and it didn't want to stop. And, you know, it wasn't really a great game from our perspective. We were pitching okay, but our defense wasn't great, and we sure weren't hitting. But that was all beside the point. I was like looking at Brenda now and again thinking, if she gives me the sign, I think I could be persuaded that we're going to leave. But we weren't. I had a hot dog and a beer, and I got her a $12 glass of wine. And, you know, we're really enjoying the moment. So it was all really great. I sent a picture to my brother, who is the world's biggest Cubs fan. He flew to Washington, D.C. to watch games 1 and 2, for crying out loud. I said, why don't you come to Chicago? I live 2 blocks away. He said, no. I said, it's easier for me to fly from Denver to Washington than Denver and Chicago because I can fly to Washington from Denver, get a ticket to the Cubs-Nationals game, and fly back for less than the Cubs tickets will cost me. That's just the value. That's just the demand for Cubs playoff tickets. So, you know, I didn't want to give up that opportunity. I said, yeah, so we go to the game. And sitting 2 rows in front of me and 6 seats to the right, Nick Offerman, also of Manuka Community High School in Grundy County. Yes, the television star was there, and he had a pink piece of plastic pulled over his head like everybody else, and he was sitting quietly in misery watching the game with the rest of us.
Did you compare teachers?
I got a text right away from my son, who's a big Nick Offerman fan, and he said, did you get a selfie? And I'm like, I'm not that kind of guy. I said, if he wants a selfie with me, I'll give him one, but it's the ball's in his court.
I would have totally, though, said, hey, I went to the high school. Did you have such and such for math? No, not at all, huh?
I saw Nick Offerman's friends going, John Williams is right over there. Why don't you go get a selfie with him? It'll be so awesome. You're both from Manuka. But we did not. I let the man have his peace, and folks were generally leaving him alone. He sang with Who is from Mad Men?
John Hamm?
No, the female. Pretty girl. She's
January
got
Jones?
Nope. There's only
Moss,
four.
Elizabeth Moss. You're kidding me.
Yeah, Elizabeth Moss and Nick Offerman, strangely, saying, take me out to the ball game. Sitting about four rows behind them, and more to my immediate right, were four or five guys who, and this is the picture that I tweeted. You'll see it. It's very funny. I'm telling you, I've got like 30 likes. It's huge. It's a picture of me with three Cubs fans, and they've all got surgical masks on to protect them from the rampant mold problem they have at Wrigley Field. That was funny until Strasburg came out and shut us down. But before the game, Dusty Baker, their manager, was saying, well, you know, it's really hard for us here because we're in a hotel and the air conditioning isn't great and we got a mold problem. It's really hard to play baseball. So that was Dusty Baker's explanation for why they were down in the series. But then evidently Strasburg got a better antibiotic and he came out and returned to form. But it was funny to see these people anticipating that with the gauze mask, the surgical mask over their face to protect them from the mold. So I tweeted out, brave the cold, brave the mold. Go Cubs. I'm kind of proud of that, and the internet rewarded me with 30 little red hearts. But then those same delightful guys that I got my picture taken with kept drinking beer, and they all got drunk. And one of them was the kind of guy at a game when he gets drunk who then starts to get mad at the fans because they're not as big a Cub fan as he is. Now, it was a bad night for baseball, and our team was doing badly. And even though it was game four of a championship, not the World Series, but obviously the divisional series, the fans were there. We were into it. My God, we know what's going on here. We want to go to the World Series again. Every game's important. We were standing when we had nobody on, but our batter had three balls. People were standing and cheering like, okay, let's get a runner. To me, that's into it. But we weren't into it enough for this guy. And so while we were all frequently sitting down, he was standing up and saying, come on, I can't believe you people. This is the playoffs. You call yourself Cubs fans. This was his way of doing the Cubs game when he's drunk. And his friends were kind of going like, you know, Bob, you're drunk and you're an idiot. But they were also kind of laughing because he was funny to them. He wasn't funny to the guy, though, that was in charge of our aisle. And so he kept coming over going, you know, you're blocking people's views. But they let the guy finish the game. And he was there to the very bitter end, standing in front of people, drunk and obnoxious. And just kind of ruining a miserable night for other people, making it even worse, you know. I don't understand those people, Steve. And I felt bad for the usher because, you know, he wasn't cussing much. He was just being a pain in the ass. And so, you know, what are we going to do about that?
So was Strasburg.
Oh, man. Yeah, he looked pretty good.
You know, you got to give him, I mean, I take it all back if I said anything unfair yesterday because, wow. Have you ever had, you know, there are businesses, we've had them on, where you can get your fluid, get it IVs.
I've done this before.
You have?
I have done. You can get it prophylactically or you can get it. Help you. I've done it before. If you're going to take a long flight, they'll come to your office, they'll give you an IV, and they'll put you fluids and the right kind of medication in you so you won't be have jet lag. You can get it for hangovers. You're talking about this,
right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
People say that doctors would do it all the time to themselves for the hangovers.
Yeah, right. I got one of those. And here's what I noticed. Mine wasn't for a hangover. I wasn't hungover when I got it. They just came into my studio one day, and we did this. It's a company now that will do this. Like, if you and your family are going to fly to Spain tomorrow, you would be advised to spend $100. You all get the fluid, inject it into your thing. It comes in a little gurney. They hook the bag up, send you the fluids. And then when you get to Spain, you feel better than you would if you had.
What are they putting in my body, though, when
they do that? I have no idea. Magical chemicals.
I guess if you do it once a year when you travel.
Fluids.
I think you can do it all the time. There's no limit to how much money they want from you.
But who knows what's in there?
They do.
Other
than
them.
Presumably safe.
It's a medical thing.
But I'll tell you one weird thing about it. When they do this, I mean, this is my experience, and they told me this is common. They put that stuff in there and, like, you know, you're waiting for this miracle. Aha! I'm about to perform well. Like, you could go get one of these before you ran a track meet or something. But you immediately, I mean, as soon as the needle goes in and the fluid starts coming in, you go, you taste metal.
Really?
You get a overpowering metal sensation like aluminum.
Gross.
And that's the juice working. That's it coming into your system. And it's,
I'm pretty sure we can sign Elif up now. She sounds like she's ready.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Have you ever been hungover, jet-lagged, or sick with the flu? And you go, oh, there's nothing I can do about it. Well, this is what you do about it. You have them hook you up with this bag, and you're good to go, either before or after.
I mean, colds, right? I mean, if you, yeah. These things that linger, you can just go get an IV?
And they said, well, you can drink a lot of fluids and take a lot of vitamin C, but that doesn't get there as quickly, and this gets there right now, Jack. So I'm not against it.
It just seems like most of the time, those things that have those immediate results are dangerous.
Yeah.
That's because you buy them at bars. These are different.
No, I
even
get it.
Even that's not immediate.
No, I understand what you're talking about, Elif. I get it. I, to be honest with you, I was really dubious about it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, really, what am I doing here? I wonder that. A guy's going to come. I don't know. Actually, it was an attractive gal. And she put a needle in my arm and ran a bag of fluid into me. And I was doing it as a, you know, sort of a radio conversation. I thought, what the heck am I doing here? But I survived, and I don't know if I felt better. I didn't feel terrible, so I can't tell you about its efficacy. But I can tell you that too much beer is a bad idea at the ball game, which leads me then to the saying that I should almost do every day on the radio. So as we all go through colds and maybe anxious moments of baseball games, or we're worried about the health of the world because the crazy people are running it, we should remember the following four lines after this. Actually, speaking of all of that, and frustrations with the world or the rain at the Cubs game or whatever, this is the Instagram post that Brenda pointed out to me. And I thought, oh, hello, John McCormick, real smart guy at the Chicago Tribune. Nice to see you, sir. Just walking by, giving me the peace sign. That was the peace sign, wasn't it? So with, you know, with all the turmoil in the world, this sort of saying is circulating on the internet, and good that it is. And it is four lines. Happiness is the new rich. Inner peace is the new success. Health is the new wealth. Kindness is the new cool. Perhaps all of us want to be rich or successful or wealthy or cool, but happiness is the new rich. It kind of reminds me of that commercial for Private Vista. I mean, sure, you want to have enough money to retire, but you really want to be happy, and that's not about money. Happiness is the new rich. Inner peace is the new success. Health is the new wealth. And kindness is the new cool. Maybe that last one is the one that could help us all the most if we could learn to live it. Kindness is the new cool. So Eminem has come out with a rap that now has 20 million views. It's been out for about a week. I don't know, it's been out that long. When they wrote about it in the Chicago Tribune yesterday, they noted that it had 8 million hits. I looked at it today, it had 20 million views. 20 million views. And I forget the number of comments in it, which is sometimes a better metric to understand how something's resonating, but it was a gigantic number as well. So what did Eminem sing or say, and what does it mean? Now, I can't play it all for you here on WGN, although it did debut on the BET Awards. I don't know if they were bleeping it on television or not, but I'm going to play a little of it for you and then ask you for your reaction to it. We'll do that after the news. Have you heard it, by the way, Steve? I know you're a big Eminem fan. Every time you get into Steve's car, it's Eminem, bam, bam, bam.
Sorry about that. No, I have not heard it.
Yeah. Well, you'll hear a little of it here, and we'll talk about that. And I'll preview a little more of the book that I just think is fantastic, and I think you'll enjoy, The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse by Rich Cohen. You've heard of Three Finger Brown, right? Mordecai Brown, the guy that used to pitch for the Cubs. You know, he was on the team with Tinker, Zevers, and Chance. And the things that Rich just sort of tells are just fun and fantastic, and he'll be talking with us a little later on as well. Here on GN. Here I was trying to say nice, cheerful, positive, affirming things on the radio, and I read that little Instagram post. Happiness is the new rich. Kindness is the new cool. Health is the new wealth. Hey, John, health is the new wealth. Only if you can afford insurance. What with Trump just did to the ACA, it's more like wealth is the new health. Ha! I have ACA and I'm scared. Yeah, listen, every day we're all scared. John Work leads to paychecks. Paychecks lead. Oh, I see. Work leads to paychecks. Paychecks lead to cash, which leads to happiness. I don't think you're all tracking on what I was trying to do there. I was trying to say that. I don't know what I was trying to say.
They just killed your vibe.
I know. They just yucked my yum.
Don't let them do it.
They gave you a one on vibe score.
That's right. My vibe score is way down. Wait till the bright side. Actually, we're not doing the bright side tomorrow. I'm taking the day off. So there. Now you won't have me to kick around for a day.
You're not here tomorrow?
No. I'm taking the day off. I'm going to the Blackhawks game tonight with some friends in from out of town. And so I thought I'd play with them tomorrow rather than play with you guys here.
That's great. Have fun.
You might see Stephanie there, whose birthday is today.
Yeah, happy birthday to our sort of executive producer here at this fine little radio station. We got this promotional piece. I'm not in the habit of reading them, but I think this will be good for America. It says, tomorrow, take steps to reduce plastic waste polluting our water supply. And they sent us a little... So I had a Pyrex glass bottle here with a nice cap that's resealable. You put your water in here instead of buying disposable water, bottles that we all throw away then and adds to more pollution. It says here, this is provided by the global water purification leader Blue Water and local nonprofit Friends of the Chicago River. Tomorrow, take steps to reduce plastic waste polluting our water supply and fill this bottle at the Chicago Riverwalk's new hydration station, which is located on the Bridge House Museum Plaza. That's near Michigan and Wacker on the Riverwalk. When you go down, you'll see it there. The Riverwalk at Michigan and Wacker. And when you go down there now, they'll have a water station. The hydration station's purpose is to provide free drinking water that is also totally free of contaminants like lead and plastic. A recent study showed that 83% of tap water contains plastic fibers, while reducing single-use plastics that pollute Chicago's water supply. So, I've been looking for a kind of a handy everyday water bottle, so I'll use that, and maybe you've got one yourself. Reuse it, and you can refill it at Wacker in Michigan with water that's, I guess, supposed to be healthier for you or something. So M&M is this Michigan white rapper, and all of that matters in a description of him in this case. I'm reading from Barry Weiss's op-ed piece. She's an editor at the New York Times and wrote an opinion piece about Eminem's latest rap, which the way I'm looking at it on YouTube now has 20 million views. I think Ro was talking about this with Rhymefest the other day, so I'm kind of catching up here. Barry Weiss wrote, Eminem is far from the first rapper to trash the current American president. And then she mentions a California rapper named YG, a young rapper named NMA, Chance the Rapper took a shot at him on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And then Barry Weiss writes, yet Eminem's The Storm, which is a scathing 4-minute attack on the, quote, kamikaze that will probably cause a near Holocaust, debuted at the BET Awards on Tuesday night. When she wrote it, she said it's already garnered 8.7 million views, but I looked at it, and now it's up to 20. What gives? Some of the overwhelming reaction to the rap as evidence of racism that Eminem's song is generating such overwhelming attention because he's white. There's no denying that the key difference between the rappers mentioned above and Eminem isn't that he's the only one from Detroit. Maybe this matters because he's white, but it's more than that, she says. A recent New York Times article looked at the music fandom across the country, and it noted that Eminem's base is strongest in whiter and more rural places. Eminem's fans are in West Virginia, Southern Ohio, Eastern Kentucky, Deep North Maine, the Ozarks in Missouri, and across the Great Plains. They wrote that before this song came out. They just happen to be describing Eminem's bass. That is as red as it can get. Knowing that full well, Eminem has a new song out called The Storm, in which he's speaking directly to Donald Trump. And he begins it. I want to make sure I start with the right one. We'll start with Eminem number one here, Elif. He starts with the calm before the storm.
It's the calm before the storm right here.
And then he pauses, and then he says, I don't even know how to start this. And then he starts it. It's as barren as that. There's no backup singers. There's no music. It's just him in a cement parking garage or deck. There's a bunch of old school cars parked around him in the background, semicircle with their headlights on. And then some young African-American men standing around the cars watching. And that's it. And it's Eminem just pacing back and forth on the cement. And he's talking to you and me and to the president. And he says that a lot of what the president is doing, the talk of the walls and so forth, is to distract us.
It's like we take a step forwards, then backwards. But this is his form of distraction. Plus, he gets an enormous reaction when he attacks the NFL. So we focus on that and instead of talking Puerto Rico with gun reform for Nevada. All these horrible tragedies, and he's bored and would rather cause a Twitter storm with the Packers.
And there's periods of time where he'll, you know, take 2, 3, 4 seconds and just pace and sweat and pant and think. And then he goes back at it again. In this case, mocking his fans. I mean, remember now, his fans are in West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, and they're for the wall. And they like Donald Trump's position on immigration, for instance. But he gets right in their face when he says this.
He's going to get rid of all immigrants. He's going to build that thing up taller than this. And any fan of mine who's a supporter of his, I'm drawing in the sand a line. You're either for or against. And if you can't decide who you like more in your split on who you should stand beside, I'll do it for you with this.
Had to edit some of that. But he said you're either with me or with him, but you can't have it both ways. They point out that in the New York Times article, when Kendrick Lamar blasts Donald Trump, he's preaching to the choir. When Eminem does it, there's a good chance that Trump voters are listening. So this is being heard in southern Ohio and eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. In the Times, they say in 1990, Michael Jordan refused to endorse a North Carolina Democratic candidate on the grounds that Republicans buy sneakers too. Those were Michael Jordan's words. Why don't you get political? He said, because Republicans buy sneakers too. Many have suggested that this logic muffles pop stars like Taylor Swift, who was mum during the presidential election and whose silence persists. Does anybody want Taylor Swift to, you know, join the angry chorus or the supportive chorus for this president? I don't think she has to, and I don't think that's her cashing in either. If she wants to, she should. If she doesn't want to, she does not have to. I'm not critical of her in this case.
As long as she doesn't make a big spectacle about it and herself.
What do you mean by that?
Just as long as she makes it short and sweet, and it's not like she's, it's not her trying to be, I mean, she's good, but I just, I have a bias against her. I guess I should stop there.
Well, if you go to a concert, I think you want to hear your favorite star, right? I don't know. I'm trying to think of who is political on stage. Madonna was, for instance. And I know that if you went to a Madonna show and she started to crack wise about somebody, that's kind of what you came for. If a rap star does that, you might go, yeah, well, that's part of the package. It's not part of Taylor Swift's package. And if she doesn't want to insert that in there, I don't have any problem with Taylor Swift not being political. I don't think she's copping out. Am I right about that? And if my but I also have felt, and it's a funny thing, isn't it, that Michael Jordan's voice, at least back in the day, was conspicuously absent. I do think he had a golden opportunity. If Taylor voice piles on, I guess that's not really going to move the needle. But I think it would have been interesting to hear what Michael Jordan had to say because he had a very broad audience. Anyway, the New York Times writes, Eminem knows that Republicans buy songs, his songs. His message to them is to stop buying. After focusing on the evils of the what he called racist 94-year-old grandpa in the White House, he gives his Trump supporter fans an ultimatum. I'm drawing in the sand a line. You're either for or against, he says. And those fans have heard him loud and clear. Many are vowing never to listen to Eminem again. Eminem is not the first entertainer. And when I first heard about this, I don't know, Steve, if you hear that Eminem is dissing maybe his fans to make a political point, does somebody else come to mind? Have we ever heard this story before? I immediately thought of the Dixie Chicks. And I wrote to my son and I said, Griff, isn't this a little like the Dixie Chicks? And he felt that it was actually a bigger risk for the Dixie Chicks then, that that really was gigantic. You remember on stage, here's the soundbite. So this is the Dixie Chicks. I think they were in Germany. Elif and I found them doing this in a number of places. But this is, I think, the Dixie Chicks in Germany in 2003. And they famously said,
"We're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas."
And the crowd cheered. And then they had to reinvent themselves. Radio stations vowed to stop playing them. They were burning their CDs and albums and posters. You know, that was the end of the Dixie Chicks as you knew them for a really long time. I mean, they're country music stars. And they went after George Bush of Texas. So they must have known what they were doing. And boy, did they get it. You know, and then they come back with politically tinged sometimes music. And the fans are still cheering, maybe a different set of fans, or maybe the times have changed, but the Dixie Chicks maybe today are having the last laugh, or at least Natalie Maines. I don't know what's going to happen to Eminem. He wasn't top of mind for me anyway lately. How relevant is Eminem these days anyway? This is the end of the New York Times piece. Maybe it's cynical of us to attribute cynicism to Eminem, but they do point out that he does have a new album coming out next month. And this might be a good way to get somebody on WGN Radio or somebody in Kentucky to start talking about him again. Anyone who cares about this country, though, the op-ed piece says, has a right to speak his mind, and rappers with a huge following have a platform to change the minds of others. So you go, Eminem, you do your thing, and you'll pay the price for it. I say all of that to also just say this. I've been thinking about the NFL athletes who some of us are hoping will take a knee on Sunday. That's what we do now. We wait for the football games, and then we wait to see what happens before the football games. Jerry Jones has said he will not play players who take a knee. So what's going to happen now? Maybe that thing is going away. Maybe that won't be an issue anymore. Everybody's going to stand or we'll figure out how to do it.
Well, you see, the NFL might adopt a rule.
Yeah, saying that they have to. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they will.
That would be a mistake, I think.
For them to adopt the rule.
Yeah.
I quite agree with you on that. But I also suppose there is a rule. Suppose there isn't a rule. But let's suppose there is. I want the players to take a knee. Not because I care about Colin Kaepernick, or not because I even know why they're taking a knee. But I don't want the government to put so much pressure on these athletes that they refuse to express themselves. That, to me, is chilling. So now I'm protesting the absence of a protest. I want them to take a knee. You go, guys! Which is very easy for me to say, because it won't cost me $3 million if I do, or if you do. I want them to do it. You know, I want them to have the courage of their convictions. I want them to put their money where my mouth is, and I don't know that that's fair to them, right? So if they don't want to take a knee because it could cost them forever, I understand. My phone number is 312-981-7200. Lots of calls and your texts coming up. Yeah, this is interesting. You guys are paying attention. Hey, John, Lin-Manuel Miranda did the same thing. That is, you know, put his politics in front of his pocketbook after he made $1 billion. But still, he stood strong and will pay the price if maybe conservatives or Republicans don't like his message. Jane Fonda, John, did the same thing in the Vietnam era. I suppose so. Hey, John Bono, Bono from U2 preaches his truth. Love the Dixie Chicks, but I never listened to them again after that, says this texter. If you have knee pain, it might be keeping you from hiking. It might keep you awake at night when you turn in bed. I never thought about that. I've had knee pain for a few years now. I never thought it was so bad that when you turn in bed at night, it will wake you and you have to manage literally getting comfortable again. But that's some of you, isn't it? Maybe it keeps you dancing from, dancing at your daughter or son's wedding. What a shame that would be. And I think a lot of people have tried things to cure their knee pain, or they just have never tried because they thought, oh, that's the way it is. I've got arthritis in the knee, the tissue's burnt out, and I can't fix it. And I don't want to go under the knife. You should do what I did. Go to the Joint Relief Institute. I was there yesterday. I talked a little bit about it at the beginning of the show. The Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park. They use advanced digital technology to see why and exactly where your knee is bothering you. They showed me the x-ray. I go, there's your cartilage, cartilage, cartilage. There's no cartilage. That's bone. That's bone. That's where it hurts. I go, I know. That's exactly where it hurts. And then they did this for me, and they'll do this for you. They gently place an all-natural joint lubricant into your knee. That sounds like a euphemism for they stick you with a needle. They put a needle in there, and I did not know it. It's pain-free. Most insurance and Medicaid pays for the treatment, which is nice to know. If you've been discouraged by other treatments, or you just think, well, that's how my life is, I want you to call this number because I feel great. I can't wait to play basketball this weekend. And that's a fact. Call 708-888-0000. 708, they're in Orland Park, 888-0000. 708-888, you can remember that, and 0000 as in zero pain. It's 155. Jim, you're on WGN. This is John Williams. What can I do for you?
John, how are you today?
Good. Talk to me, man.
So I was at a Ted Nugent concert probably about 20 years ago, and I'm a Ted Nugent fan, and I am a NRA guy and a gun guy, and you know. But I walked into the concert, and he played maybe a couple of songs, and next thing you know, he starts ranting and raving about gun rights and this and that. And he went on for about 20 minutes.
Really?
I left.
But
yeah,
he's
left.
But, I mean, he's singing your song. He's your guy.
Yeah, but I don't need to be preached to either. You know, I just I believe what I believe. I know what I know. I went there to be entertained, not preached.
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
So I mean, and I still listen to his music, and I still like him, and I still believe in, you know, all that stuff. But I find myself doing, you know, going to concerts less or going to these, you know, like following football. Like I disagree with the guys taking the knee for one reason or another, but I totally 100% support their right to do it, even though I disagree with their actions.
And you know, I'm trying to think of, okay,
right.
And suppose, it's funny that you mentioned that. I'm glad you called, Jim, because if my politics are different than yours, say some entertainer is up there spewing some liberal stuff that resonated with me, I didn't go there to sit in an echo chamber. I want to hear some music, right?
Right, right, exactly.
I think on that, you and I very much agree. I really appreciate your call. Thanks for jumping in here.
Thanks for having me.
And have a good day. Judy said, even if they knee, they should put their hand on their heart. Thank you for that call, Judy. Maureen said that she would take a knee during the game. Maureen would take a knee during the game. I wonder if it's going to resonate in civilian life, if some of us are going to be asked to put ourselves on display like these other people are. It's a very vulnerable place. It's 150. I haven't seen the fans take a stand.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
208. Well, I missed my cue there where I say a little funny thing, but I guess I was thinking a big thought. Hi, it's John. I'm here till 3.
Lord have mercy.
And we're going to talk a little baseball in the first half hour of this hour. Afterwards, we'll talk a little bit about restaurants. Phil Vitale was going to join us yesterday. He couldn't make it in. I like talking to Phil, and we all like to eat, so we'll do a little chat about that in the second half hour. The Chicago Cubs is the story of a curse. The book is written by Rich Cohen. It's just come out. He is not a Chicago native. He says he lives in Connecticut and is not proud of it, and the jacket to his book. But his book is really good. And as a Chicagoan and a bit of a baseball fan, I'm not a crazy baseball fan, but I think Chicagoans and Chicago baseball fans and baseball fans, those can be three separate groups, would all love this book because it tells such great stories and it tells them so well. Rich, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
You were on stage with Mark Baser at the Hideout last Friday, and that was a great conversation too.
always fun. It's like, you know, he's Johnny Carson.
He is.
I'm his Don Rickles guy going every
day. I keep waiting for Baser to pop, and he sort of is now. He's got a sort of weekly show on Channel 11. It's not on every week. You see him on commercials for Lifeway Kefir now. So Baser's profile is going up, but there's no stage that he couldn't be on. He's just a very unassuming interviewer. And he's funny and smart, and he reads the books.
Yeah, he's great.
He knows what he's talking about. And you do, too. But I would have advised you not to write a book about the Cubs and the curse, for crying out loud. Hasn't that been done before?
Well, it's funny, because I wrote a book about the 85 Bears called Monsters. I actually grew up in Glencoe. And I went to interview Mike Ditka, and he said, you know how many books have been written about that team? Why would you want to write that book again? And I said, you know how many times you ran that same offense? Why'd you keep running that same offense? Presumably you thought it worked and you could do it better than anyone had ever done it. I think the same thing. I think I can sort of get it definitively in a way it's never been done. And Ditka looked at me and said, okay, let's sit down.
How'd that go?
That went well. I had a really funny thing with Ditka where...
Was he crazy then, or did that come later?
It's come on grad. I think he's always been crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I interviewed Brian McCaskey, spent time with Brian McCaskey, who was a kid. You know, his grandfather, George House, and they were terrified of Ditka when he was a player. They thought he was like a monster, yeah. You know. And I interviewed him again later on for Sports Illustrated. Oh, yeah, for the Ditka coaching tree. And I said, you know, I've interviewed you before several times, you know. And he said, oh, what? So you think that, like, I'm so old and I was hit in the head so many times that I don't remember who you are or know about your wife and your kids or what's going on with your family? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you're right. I have no idea who you are.
Touché. Well, so, okay. You are better at telling this story than other people are.
That's the goal. I mean, truth is, like, I grew up a Cubs fan. First game was 1976. Favorite team was 1979. Buckner and Dave Kingman and everything. And I've been writing about them all along, but only when they won the World Series last year did I think really the story could be written.
Maybe so, but maybe it's also a book that didn't have to be written, but you had to write it. This was too important to you. I got that sense in this. And God bless you that you did it so well, because the Chicago Cubs story of a curse, I don't think that's a great title for you, because this is more than that. And maybe you can't get everything the book is in a title. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I love the story. And in fact, let me just read to you a little bit of you. Okay, this is early in your book. And I wonder if this is actually true, because you talk about being a Cub fan and how if the team is cursed, maybe so too are its fans. You were walking out after a loss to, I think it was the Reds when you were a child. And your dad says to you, I want you to promise me something. I want you to promise me you will not be a Cubs fan. Why? Because the Cubs do not win, he explained. And because of that, the Cubs fan will have a diminished life determined by low expectations. Look at me. I know I am going to succeed. You know why? Because I'm a Yankees fan. We win and expect to win, but a Cubs fan knows he will lose. He's sitting there waiting for it to happen. He'll settle for a less of a result. His team has taught him that all human endeavor ends in failure. That team will screw up your life. Or words to that effect. But I mean, really, you and your dad had a conversation?
Absolutely.
Like,
and even, to me, the killer was 1984. I was in high school. I went to New Trier High School. And when they lost to the San Diego Padres 3 straight games in a best of 5 series, I was so upset. You know, that was like I went outside and I just wept. And right at that moment when I was so upset, I looked at my father. He was sitting there. And he started to say something like fatherly and consoling. And then he sort of said, I told you what would happen. You know, but I do think he was genuinely happy when they finally won the World Series last year.
Well, he wasn't was he not a Cubs fan?
Yankees fan.
Yeah, but I mean, you could be both? No.
No, I mean, he didn't feel any stronger. He liked going to Wrigley Field. He really grew up in Brooklyn. He was a Yankees fan, which was very unusual in Brooklyn. And I think he just did it to be a contrarian. And he used to love going to Wrigley Field because it reminded him of Ebbets Field.
It's a point you visit later in the book, though. You say there is something to the culture. If you go to the Yankees training camp and if you play for the Yankees, there's an expectation to win, and that is somehow communicated through literally the posters on the walls, but it's communicated to the players, and they therefore win. maybe a reason the Cubs haven't won, you suppose.
Well, one you say about the title, and it's the good thing about the title is it gave me a way to think about the book, which is you explore the curse through the whole history of the franchise before the Billy Goat, going back to the very beginning. You know, the first Chicago Cubs baseball stadium burned in the Chicago fire. They didn't win the pennant because of that. You know, it goes all the way back to the beginning.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then 1907, 1908, you know, that whole thing. And I went on, I've always been interested, why can't the Cubs win as a fan? Like, the fact is they spent as much money. They always brought these kind of messiahs to Chicago, whether it was Dusty Baker or Lou Piniella or Leo DeRocher or whoever it was, Dallas Green. And I went out on the road with the Cubs for Harper's Magazine 2000, and I just asked the players, and the best source to me to explain this was Joe Girardi, I thought, because he grew up in Peoria. He's a Cubs fan. He started his career at the Cubs, and then he went and won two World Series with the Yankees and came back to the Cubs. And he said it was absolutely the expectations, which is we're told that if you have a 500 season, that's a good season. And that's a success. And in New York, they were told if you don't make the World Series, you failed. And then, two, the pictures on the walls. They have all these pictures of great Yankees teams with Mickey Mantle, Joe DiMaggio, you know, whoever, on the mound celebrating. I said, we have pictures here, too. He goes, yeah, but look at them. They're all people by themselves. It's Hack Wilson alone, Fergie Jenkins alone, Ernie Banks alone. There's sense in Wrigley. I always thought as a Cubs fan, you got kind of a bad team, but they always gave you one great player to sort of get you through. And I always thought as a Cubs fan, you're kind of wandering around in the wilderness like the ancient Hebrews, wandering around the desert for 40 years, and you had got one Moses figure who would lead you around and prevent you from dying out there.
Why did you spend so much time at the beginning of the book talking about the 06, 07, 08 teams?
Because I grew up in Connecticut, and my kids are Cubs fans, and I made them Cubs fans. I told them I'd punish them if they did not become Cubs fans. And one day my son showed up with a shirt that said, don't hate on 08. And I started thinking, like, 1908's a number that's always evoked as the last World Series, but nobody really knows what the story is. And 1908 was arguably the greatest team in the history of baseball, that Cubs team, and incredibly exciting team, you know. And they in 1908, they won this incredibly tense pennant race where people thought they stole the pennant from the New York Giants because of Merkel's boner, the game where the close game at the end, a guy didn't touch second at the end of the game, a run didn't count that should have counted. The Cubs sort of, and the owner of the New York Giants actually made a ring for his team that said to the 1908 Giants, the real winners, the real champions of the National League. So, and it ends up in this kind of the craziest game in baseball history, which was the Cubs won this game they shouldn't have won. There was a one-game playoff.
Earlier in the season. Yeah,
but it was late. It was like in September.
And because of a bad call by the official, by the umpire,
well,
right?
It was actually technically the right call.
But, I see.
The deal was, in baseball, if there's two outs and a man on third and the run crosses the plate but there's a force out, the run doesn't count. Okay? But baseball stadiums are so crazy back then that when that play happened, when the run came in, the guys on the bases would see the crowd pour out of the stands, and they would run for their lives to the clubhouse.
Even before they got to first base?
They would just break off. The play was over. It was like a walk-off home run.
We've scored, yeah.
And even in a walk-off home run, you have to go around the bases. But back then, they didn't do it, and it had been a traditional play. No one ever did that. It was a regular thing. In this one game, the Cubs infielder knew the rule. He talked to the umpire before. The guy didn't touch, you know, Fred Merkel was a 19-year-old guy from Wisconsin, didn't make it the second. He took off as soon as the winning run scored. And the crowd's on the field, and they went and they got the ball. The ball was in the outfield. He had a Giants fan wouldn't give it up. He sort of knocked him out.
Okay, so hold on a second. I mean, you spend time describing this scene. So think about, was it a walk-off home run that we're talking about?
It was a walk-off single.
Walk-off single, but he still has to circle the base.
He has to touch second to complete the play. Because
oh my gosh.
If a guy gets the ball, a Cub, and touches second, then he's out.
Okay, so.
Because he never touched second.
And so the ball is in the outfield. The fans are storming the field. Everybody knows that the game is over. But the Cubs player knows, right, the rule.
Right.
And so they've got to get that ball and tag him out. But now it's pandemonium breaking out.
Right.
There's a fan with the ball. He won't give him the ball. They conk that guy on the head. The ball drops out.
Right. It's Johnny Evers, who's this incredibly tough second baseman, Hall of Famer. And he's running through the crowd. And, they, you know, the Giants fans slowly figure out what's going on. And they're, like, attacking him. He gets the ball. He throws it to Joe Tinker, who's a shortstop, who catches it, and actually the ball sails, and Iron Joe McGinnity, who actually would later turn out to be the first quarterback of the Bears. Okay, he comes out on the field, and they fight for like 5 minutes. Then McGinnity takes the ball and throws it. He thinks out of the stadium. These guys claim not. They go get the ball. They come back. They fight their way, and they touch second, and the umpire yells, you're out.
And the umpire has to be paying attention to this.
The umpire's waiting for it because they've already had a discussion about it.
So he knows that if Johnny, you didn't touch second base.
Johnny Evers set him up earlier, said, you know, that should be an out every time.
It's amazing. So pandemonium, minutes, balls thrown all around. They get the ball, and they touch it. And now they have to tell these fans in the celebrating, oh, no, you didn't just win this game.
Right, and the umpire goes walking through the crowd telling everybody, the run doesn't count. The game's
it's not over.
And Joe Tinker says it's the greatest act of courage he'd ever seen in his life because attacking him. And then the crowd hears what's going on, and they attack the Cubs' clubhouse. The Cubs are barricaded in their clubhouse with the mob trying to get in. The New York police have to come and form like a barricade and lead them out of the stadium. And then my favorite little detail is John McGraw, was the Giants manager, one of the greatest managers in history. He basically keeps Fred Merkel at the stadium until like 2 in the morning when everybody's gone, and then he has him go out and touch second so that if when there's a hearing and they say, did you touch second, he can say yes without lying.
It's those sort of little anecdotes that you tell in the book that just make it so much more fun than a run-of-the-mill book. We'll continue in a minute. The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse by Rich Cohen. He's in our studio. The book just came out. I'm recommending it to all my patients who chew gum. And that's 1906, 07, 08 we're talking about here. They have to use your book as the basis for the movie because then you catch up with these guys later in life. I don't want to dwell on that, but it's just spectacular. But let's talk more about last season and this season in a minute on WGN. I've been enjoying the Chicago Cubs' Story of a Curse by Rich Cohen. He's the author of Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears, and The Wild Heart of Football. He writes about some of these iconic Chicago stories. And this one is not just about the curse or the Cubs last year or the Cubs in 1908. It's kind of weaves all of that together. But I have to tell you, I just so much enjoyed some of the stuff you said about Babe Ruth. I mean, so then what you said about the baseball in the 40s was terrific. What you said about it a century ago is really amazing. Now, what do you say about the Cubs last year? Let's start there. We've got a few minutes. What stood out to you most besides the obvious?
Well, I was at a Cubs game. I was at the NLCS last year, and the Cubs were winning 1-0 against the Dodgers, and the game was tied late. And as a kid who grew up at Wrigley Field, sort of, and a lifetime Cubs fan, I sort of thought, it's all over. I mean, it was 1-1, but it was like 10-0. I thought, yeah, you know, this is
felt
finished.
Like we were losing.
My old cup, the thing my father warned me about, it kicked in, you know, and and all of a sudden, all around me, I'm sitting in the press box, but in the grandstand, I hear people chanting, and I can't understand what they're saying, you know. So I said to the sports writer next to me, "What are they saying?" He said, "They're saying we don't quit." And I just started to laugh. I'm like, "Do they know what team they're rooting for? We're the Cubs, man. We do quit. That's what we do." You know, so what amazed me was that the team was like, what Theo Epstein did was he sort of built a new team because the curse was sort of almost like a bad corporate culture that passed like a tradition from player to player and fan to fan through the generation. As soon as something went wrong, everybody would just hug that thing.
Here we go again.
And it would just become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I always said everybody, every generation you'll see the goat in a different guise, you know?
I think you're right about that. Although I don't believe in the curse. You don't.
But it's not a literal curse. It's a story that you've become captive of, you know, and basically it's like a bad culture. There are all kinds of reasons. Phil Wrigley's the biggest cause. He didn't build a farm system. He didn't get black players. He did all these bad things. He wasn't really interested in baseball. He didn't go to Wrigley Field the last 20 years of his life that he owned the team. You know, and he made that Faustian bargain where he traded sort of a good team for a good stadium. So you didn't get a great team, but you got Wrigley Field instead. But over time, like when you go around and you'd ask these guys, they'd come to Wrigley Field. I interviewed a bunch of guys, and they'd say, you know, they're great at baseball their whole lives. They're the best in Little League, the best in their town, the best in their farm team. They get to Chicago, they put the Cubs hat on their head, and they say, now you're a lovable loser. And they say, you know, that story would start to seep in. And what Theo Epstein did was he built like an entirely new team in the farm system. All had them come up all together, almost like growing a plant in a greenhouse, and then transplant them. They all came up to the Cubs within a couple of years of each other, so there was no hangover of that history. And it was almost like a new team in the old uniforms built of young players, and that's the best. because young people are stupid and they don't care about history.
Well, speaking of history, we've got to wrap this up now. But I like the fact that you note that in 06, 07, 08, Tinkers, Evers, Chance, Mordecai Brown, those guys, they hated each other. Tinkers and Evers agreed never to speak again, and for maybe a decade didn't have a conversation off the field, right?
Right, and it shows you don't have to like somebody to work very well with them.
Have to have some at least on-field chemistry, which the modern version does, but they also like each other as much as they hated each other.
Right, I always said that old team was fueled by kind of hate, and the new team is fueled by affection. But the fact is, in that team, 07, 6, 7, 8, they were more like the 85 Bears, who had this huge rivalry between Buddy Ryan and Mike Ditka. They hated each other, and that drove the team. That 06, 07, 08 team was like a ferocious, nasty team that would hurt you on the base path. This is a team, I was amazed when I look at the Cubs in the dugout, they've always got a hand on a guy. They're always touching each other.
The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse by Rich Cohen. If you've got a Cubs book, get another one. If you don't have one, get this one. It's really well done. It's nice to meet you in person.
Yeah, great to talk.
Come to our studio again. You'll be through Chicago another day, right?
Yeah.
We'll do it again. Right about the 2018. Let's see, what year is this? 2017 World Series.
Absolutely. They got to go back-to-back to repeat 07-08.
That'll be fun. Phil Vitale and I, restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. Welcome back to the show, Phil.
Thank you.
We're talking about the demise of fax machines, and you don't need to use fax machines anymore. Steve, aren't you glad you asked? Because you because you can e-sign things, right?
Right.
And I said, yeah, you don't need to fax your signature to people. You just click, click, click.
So anyway, Phil, what kind of food is around Wrigley Field?
The payoff is amazing. Just sit tight.
Thank you for that,
tight.
Phil.
Okay.
So then I said, yeah, but you got to be careful with that e-sign, because I was recently click, click, clicking through a thing and accidentally bought myself 3 years of a service I didn't want.
Oh, yeah.
And then Phil said,
congratulations, you now own a panda.
I said, it's kind of that.
It is, go, one
holy
click.
Holy cow, one click. And I said, but I don't want a panda.
Right, one
and they go,
click.
No,
and,
you own a panda, yeah. Jack. We have a panda now.
Yeah, Ling Ling on his way, air freight.
Hey, Steve,
he
that was a pretty...
He Brussels sprouts.
Hey, Steve, now you own a panda.
I got it.
Okay. Thanks for coming in, Phil.
Sure. That was actually a rejected idea that Oprah had. And
what's that?
Getting to sit quietly under the seats. These little baby pandas. So the whole you own a panda, now you have a panda, it did not test well.
I understand the pandas, and I'm glad we're talking about this now, are not nearly as friendly as they look. You know, everybody always pandas are adorable. A panda will eat you. A panda does not want you to pet it.
No, probably, I'm sure not.
Thanks for coming in. Our guest has been Phil Vitale. And he's a pet expert and a restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. Let's do what you are writing about a little bit here. And this is a fundraiser for Mexico earthquake relief.
Yes.
Let's just. I want to do this, and there's some other things I want to talk to you about, but this is important.
Rick Bayless is helping raise funds for Mexico relief. There's something, some absurd, like $2 billion of estimated damage down in Mexico from that series of earthquakes last month. And he came up with a little cocktail called Fuerza Mexico. It's a Mexican force for good, I assume.
Yeah.
And it's a $12 cocktail made with mezcal and triple sec, and you buy one of those, and $5 goes directly to earthquake relief.
He's obviously got a connection to that part of the world, and so this makes great sense for him. Isn't it funny how the... So how do I get this? How do I do this? Do I just go to his restaurant at any time?
Right. You go to Frontera Grill, Topolo Bampo, or Leña Brava, and Fonda Frontera up north. And I think it's going on through the weekend, and then that's it.
Okay, so if you do want to do this sort of earthquake relief for Mexico, you want to swing by his place through Sunday, maybe, and ask for that $12 cocktail, of which $5 will go to Global Giving's Mexico Relief Fund.
Right. Or you can go right to rickbayless.com, and there's a place to donate if you happen not to be drinking this weekend.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how many... So, I mean, doesn't Mexico seem 20 minutes ago? I mean, because after Mexico, you had Houston, and after Houston, you had South Florida, and after South Florida, you had Puerto Rico, and after Puerto Rico, I don't know, you could put Nevada in there, or for that matter, California.
Right, wine country right now, going through horrible wildfires.
You must
wildfires.
Know people out there.
I do. My wife works out there. She's in the Bay Area, in the East Bay, and in the San Francisco, from her from her place in the East Bay, we can drive to Sonoma or Napa in about an hour and 15, depending on traffic. the whole area she's works in smells of smoke. And it's an hour away by car. And it's everywhere, and people are using air filters in their homes and whatever because it's that pervasive.
My former producer, Beth Swerk, lives in Sausalito across the bay.
Oh, right.
She said it smells like a campfire in my apartment, and it's getting to people now. And that's the people that are only bothered by the smoke, to say nothing of what is the death toll now. Steve just did the number on the death toll there, but it's rising by the day.
Right.
To say nothing of the damage. Poor Beth was just in tears. And in fact, she said, here's a GoFundMe page for people because some people lost their trailer and some people lost their mansion. But what's lost on all of that is that it's not just wine country. It's a community. It's people. It's high schools. It's families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the city of Santa Rosa has been just devastated.
How about
that? Right in the middle of, it's right in the middle of the south end of Sonoma County. Yeah. And your friend lives in Marin County, which is just one county over.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And by the way, yesterday she said they are 0% contained, whatever that means. It doesn't sound good. I asked you what with folks, you know, all flocking to Wrigley Field, not that they don't do that all year long anyway, but if you were coming to, if you're lucky enough to get playoff or World Series tickets, you got some friends out there?
Nope. Somebody was just staring. I want to give them some encouragement. There they are.
Oh, yeah. I am the most... Miss America does not wave as much as I do.
No, I nor have does she wave. Need to.
No, that's right. I need the friends
that
walk by our showcase studio. Yeah. So I asked you to just give me some places, and I happen to live near Wrigley Field, so this will help me. Where are some places you recommend? Because I got plenty of places to get a beer and a burger, and some of those aren't even that good.
No.
Where are some places that a person, if they wanted to eat decently in Wrigleyville, could also go?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's tons, but close to the ballpark, one of my favorite low-key places, even on game days when everything's kind of nuts, is a restaurant called Wood, 3335 North Halsted. And that is just a creative American restaurant, has a great cocktail program. Not a place to go if you want a big TV and watch the game, because you can't do it there, but you can have a very civilized meal and very good drinks, and that's before or after the game. It's one of my favorite after ball game stops.
That's Wood, 3335 North Halsted.
And just down the way from that is Yoshi's Cafe, 3257 North Halsted.
Right.
That's been around for, a long time. Yoshi, unfortunately, passed a few years ago, but his wife continues to run the place. It's an authentic French bistro with lots of Asian, primarily Japanese.
Well, didn't you talk about that? Is that in your top 50? No.
Not
there
currently,
was
no.
I thought there was an oddly blended restaurant like that for its cuisine, like Japanese, Mexican, or French, and something else. Okay, so that's Yoshi's Cafe on North Halsted.
Mm-hmm.
What else you like?
Let's see. A little bit further north, I like Tango Sur, which is a Argentine-type steak place on Southport Avenue, 3763. So
is that real expensive? Because some of those Brazilian steak places are crazy.
So, oh, yeah. It's not one of the all-you-can-eat and the gaucho guys dressed as gauchos. I hate my job. Kind of have to walk to your table and give you, here's the chicken wings or whatever we grilled back there. No, this is you order off a menu, and it's these are steaks. They're not typically the high end, you know, doorstop sized fillets you get from other places. This is a little simpler and pretty affordable.
Tango Sur, and that's 3763 North South. Well, the Southport's a fun street. You like stuff?
I do.
So again, I'm kind of new in the neighborhood, and a lot of you all know about Southport, but I only recently discovered it in the last half year, and that's. That's better than the end of Halsted that I happen to live on. So this is great. Okay, give me something else.
Let's see. I do like Mia Francesca is in its 25th year on Clark Street. 3311 North Clark Street. There's a Francesca on every suburban block, it seems. But this is ground zero. This is numero uno. This is where it's all started.
So they're all related? They're all the same family or chain?
Yes.
How many Francescas are there?
More than 20. I think I've lost count.
Are you a fan of all of them? Are they consistently good?
It's amazing how consistent they are. I mean, it's at their level. It's very approachable. They keep they keep the prices pretty reasonable, mostly because they stay away from the beef. You know, there's not a whole lot of veal this and veal that, but they're nice pastas, and there'll be, I think, maybe one veal dish or a lot of fish, and they're doing a good job. And the big success of the Mia Francesca, I don't want to call it a chain because they're all owned and operated by the same people, but the success is that Scott Harris manages to find on-site managers that can stay within his vision.
That's a big part of any business, isn't it? Where you can't be at all 20 stores. It could be this way with dry cleaners. The dry cleaner I go to is run by a gal named Courtney, and she's dynamite. And I just have so much respect for her in that place because of her management that I see when I walk in. It must be the same way with people like this.
It's like this. It's the same way in a very large restaurant. I mean, you might be a genius chef, but if you're doing 100 covers a night or more, you have to have a team behind you that is executing according to your standards, and you need to be able to get in someone's face if he's not executing according to those standards.
Yeah,
so
right.
there are management techniques that they teach you in culinary school. So you can be a great chef yourself, but if you can't get your team to rise to your level, people are going to go, food's not that great because you can't cook everything.
It's funny, isn't it? That's I've thought about that because I've had a lot of conversations with restaurant critics, and we always come to this point where what's important is not just that you have a sense of the food, but you also have to have a sense of business.
Yeah.
And if you have one but you don't have the other, then it's too bad for you because you will not be successful.
And if you've walked around, you'll see there's a whole lot of smart businessmen cranking out mediocre food that are doing very well, and a handful of geniuses who aren't great businessmen who are dying. Mm. So
Phil Vitale's in our studio, restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. And I asked him to come up with some places around Wrigley Field because that's on our mind these days. I'll ask you for a few more.
Sure.
Get your number two pencils ready in a minute. Phil Vitale came into our studio again. It's nice talking to him, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune, focused on Wrigley Field these days. He's given us some good ideas for places to have a better meal than a burger and a beer around Wrigley. He mentioned Wood on Halsted, Yoshi's Cafe on Halsted. He also likes Tango Sur on Southport and Mia Francesca. Yeah, Francesca's on North Clark. Give me one more or two.
One or two more. I'll point out Uncommon Ground, which is just north of the park.
I go by that all the time. Is that nice?
3800 North Clark, yes. It's with Uncommon Ground, you expect it's just going to be coffee, right?
Yeah.
It's a full-service restaurant, very clean food. They have an organic garden on their rooftop, not much going on right now, but they grow a lot of their own organic ingredients, and so that's a really good one to look for. And they have live music occasionally. Last time I looked, at least, and so that one I definitely recommend. I would recommend HB Bistro, which is just a good, solid, straight up classic bistro on Halsted Street, 3404 North. That's also a good bet. And if you're actually right at the ballpark, in the park at Wrigley, one of the restaurants that opened up in there is Lucky Door by Matthias Merges. Lucky Door refers to a longtime groundskeeper at Wrigley Field. So Door is D-O-R-R.
That's his last name. Right.
And what they have is really good craft beers that they have had made especially from them by some of Chicago's best local breweries. So they have beers there that you can't get anywhere else.
Huh.
And they're made by really good brewers. And then some food that's just kind of fun plays on ballpark food. So it's probably more of a beer experience than a food experience.
You got to be in the ballpark for that?
You do not. You can go right off Waveland in the little alley leading to the park on Wrigley, but you can access the restaurant before you have to show your ticket to get into the park.
Oh, yeah. You make the left turn off of Waveland when you walk into the park. Mm-hmm. That little green space they have there, too.
And before you get to the green space,
it's right on the right-hand side.
Yes.
It is a cool venue because you can kind of sit outside, but you're inside. Mm-hmm. I love that spot. I've had some of the beer there.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was exclusive to them. What's some of the stuff I was drinking?
Right. Huh. Yeah, they do that. And that's the Matthias is one of the people that's going to be opening a restaurant inside the new hotel that's going up across the street.
You wrote about Chicago Mouse yesterday, right?
City Mouse.
City Mouse, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the Ace Hotel, which is in the Fulton Market District, which is the hottest place in the world. And everybody's going in there. And there's so much refined food up and down Fulton Market, but this place is much more casual. I don't know if you've had a chance to get into a restaurant called Giant in Logan Square, but the same the same team behind Giant, were contacted to open something inside the Ace Hotel, which is a boutique hotel. And so they wanted something much more freewheeling, much more laid back, and that's what City Mouse is. They'll have some pastas in there, which they make by hand, and they have they'll have a fish or two, but it's all really low key, and the seasoning is pretty challenging. He'll mix together things you wouldn't expect. He takes a pork ragu, basically like pork meat stew, and he piles it all over on top of fried artichokes. Which, okay,
I haven't had that yet.
You can give me quite a few shots of guessing weird flavor combinations, and I might not have come up with that ever.
Yeah, no kidding. City Mouse. Yeah. Phil, thanks for coming in. It's nice to see you again. And by the way, just a quick note, Rick Bayless's places, if you want to make a contribution to the Mexico Earthquake Relief Fund, because they're still suffering from that, and he obviously has a connection to that part of the world, you can pick up one of those fancy cocktails he's made for them with a portion of the proceeds going to that relief, or you can go to rickbayless.com and help him out that way, too. Thanks for pointing that out.
Sure.
It's almost 2:59. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis are unpacking their big thoughts and getting ready to entertain you.
I've actually packed up all my big thoughts for today.
You don't have any?
I'm FedExing them, actually.
Where are you sending them?
I don't know. Did you see that Amazon is now opening these fulfillment centers where you actually go? They have Amazon stores now that you go to and go pick up your stuff.
That sounds great.
Isn't that? Well, yeah, I mean, sort of. But I thought the whole idea of Amazon is you don't have to go anywhere.
They deliver it to you.
Yeah. Where's my drone?
Yeah, but can I ask you guys a question? What do you think of the Uber Mac delivery? You know, McDonald's delivered via Uber Eats.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain how that will work to me?
Seems like an expensive way to get a burger.
Really, if I want to order something delivered to me, I'm not ordering McDonald's. If you're going to go out and get food,
and
you go anywhere in the world, why would I have you go to McDonald's? That's the convenience food that I can get.
Well, I think the commercial tells it all. You're watching football. You're clearly single and alone.
And possibly drunk.
And possibly drunk or high, I think is really kind of what they're trying to say.
Maybe
there.
More of that.
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying
now,
to say.
Now, Taco Bell I would definitely go for because there aren't enough of those in the city of Chicago. So you do sort of need
high.
A delivery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You need
like
a
Taco
delivery.
Bell? You're a Taco Bell girl?
I do love the Taco Bell.
Why?
And there really aren't enough of them.
Really?
I don't know. I appreciate...
Are you a Chipotle person?
Not really, no.
Oh, interesting.
Taco Bell. Huh. Taco Bell is my go-to.
All the burger
food.
Joints in the world, you know what I jones for every now and then? I just don't get that itch scratch very much. It's a good old-fashioned Burger King burger.
Oh, yeah. Well, because of the flame broil.
Yeah.
Right? The flame broil changes.
Makes a difference.
Although I worked in a building with a Burger King in it.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did it smell?
The Burger King is your offset. It's your number two, number three burger. Because also Wendy's I kind of like.
Yeah.
But so actually Burger King was number three in that. And when you actually have to have Burger King on a regular basis, you're like, no.
Get sick of it.
McDonald's, you're number one. Wendy's number two. Actually, Wendy's, for me, number one feels fancier. Back before there were fancy gourmet hamburgers,
mm-hmm.
Wendy's felt
oh, yeah.
like that to me.
It was a step above.
It was the square patty,
right.
too, that you went, now what's
and the salad bar, one of the best salad bars ever.
What he said. What
underrated.
He said.
So true. Oh. And the Frosty, not bad either.
My fantasy fast food pickup is always the Arby's curly fries.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
And they give me the flame broiled burger,
uh-huh. mm-hmm.
and then the McDonald's chocolate shake. If Uber Eats would round this stuff up for
then we'd be set.
That's what they should do.
All right.